You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. If you're looking for a long movie to pass the time as you stay at home, consider Martin Scorsese's latest film, The Irishman, on Netflix. It stars Al Pacino as one of Detroit's own mafia legends, Teamsters president Jimmy Hoffa. Nearly 45 years after Hoffa went missing, it's strange to think how large this character still looms in Michigan lore. Let's revisit a conversation about the life and death of Jimmy Hoffa. I had the conversation with Scott Bernstein. He's an author and expert on organized crime in America. And Greg Stasekull. He served as FBI agent for 31 years and retired as resident agent in charge of the Ann Arbor field office. So, Scott, remind us about why Jimmy Hoffa, the leader of a prominent workers' union, got tied up with the mob.
Well, I don't think he would have been involved in the workers' union or wouldn't have risen to the heights that he had without the mob. So they were kind of, in some ways, interchangeable. So
when did that relationship start?
In the 1930s. Hoffa came here as a young boy from Brazil, Indiana, started to make his name as a labor organizer at a very young age. He was working the docks at Kroger, unpacking produce. And he, when he was, I think he was only about 20 or 21, he led what became known as the Strawberry Strike, where he organized a lot of dock workers for better wages. And it came to be known in labor circles. And he was kind of recruited by the Teamsters. And through the Teamsters Union, he was introduced to the mob by a woman who was kind of a paramour, a mob paramour that dated a lot of different gangsters, and the rest was history.
What was the Teamsters Union, and why was it so significant in being connected to the mob?
Well, the Teamsters Union was the most powerful labor union in the world. It represented truck drivers, cartage haulers, various blue-collar working-class men and women. In a lot of ways, Jimmy Hoffa becoming the president of the Teamsters became the face of the working man in America. They were so powerful because they controlled commerce. Jimmy Hoffa, as the president of the Teamsters, could pretty much shut down America with a phone call. And there was this relationship with the mafia where he gave them access to the pension fund. He gave them access to jobs and contracts within the union infrastructure. But in return, they gave him muscle. They gave him the support they needed on kind of the black market to make everything run smoothly. And
I think it's important to note that Hoffa built the Teamsters, and he built it into the largest and probably at the time the most effective union in the United States. And part of his ability to do that was his, again, the symbiotic relationship with the mob. And in order for Jimmy Hoffa to operate and to build the union into the force that it was, he had to have that relationship with the mob. And again, it went both ways. They helped him and he helped them.
It's muscle and influence.
So, Greg, you start with the FBI in 1975, the same year that Jimmy Hoffa went missing. What was it like to be part of and be a new agent in the FBI during that period of time in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, I got to Detroit, reported to Detroit from Quantico, and it was June of 1975. So it was about 2 months later that Hoffa was abducted. And that, among several other cases that happened to come down that year, I thought, wow, this is just like the movies. But on that period, and we didn't get involved with the Hoffa case right away. It was several days before the FBI actually got involved. But when we did, it was all hands on deck. And I think every available agent, and me being a relatively new agent, we went up and we were doing what we call neighborhood investigations and interviewing people and interviewing everybody that we could find, including people that had been customers at the Maccas Red Fox that day and all the surrounding businesses and everything.
How did you find out, how did you and your colleagues find out that he was missing?
Well, it was reported. Obviously, it was,
It was national news. I
mean. Yeah.
But did the FBI find out at the same time that the general public found out that he was missing? Was this something that had been leaked to the press first?
Well, it wasn't really leaked to the press. I mean, it was reported. He went to meet. He thought to meet Tony Giacalone.
He was going to a mob sit down with Tony Giacalone, who was the street boss of the Detroit Mafia, as well as a prominent New Jersey mobster by the name of Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, and they were going to discuss Teamsters business, specifically Hoffa's desire to reclaim the Teamsters presidency that he had given up about 5 years earlier.
And then he didn't return home. And his wife, of course, alerted his family. And ultimately, I believe it was his son, James, Hoffa's son, James, that reported it to the police. The state police and the local police got involved. And then within a day or so, the FBI became involved. But there were issues as to what was our jurisdiction. A missing person is obviously not within the federal jurisdiction. But ultimately, we characterized it as a kidnapping, as a way to get involved. And then we became involved more so because of the organized crime issues and some of the other things that were involved.
So what happened there from there, Scott, as far as the organized crime element? What did the group of people that would have been most closely tied to Hoffa do in that period of time?
They went into a giant disinformation campaign, which was kind of the brilliance, in my opinion, of pulling off what could be called the perfect murder. They went into a mode where they were spreading lies and, telling 50 people 50 different things. I wouldn't say they went underground. I mean, I would say in Detroit, they're kind of underground to start with. I mean, Detroit is a mob family that, is considered kind of the Cadillac of mob families, the Ivy League of mob families around the country. They operate kind of a higher plane, a more educated plane, and they've been able to have the level of success and stability, functionality that not a lot of families are able to have. And so they're always kind of beneath the surface. They live by the mantra, make money, not headlines. And they just kind of went about business as usual after Hoffa disappeared.
Was the disinformation campaign something that was organized or orchestrated, or was it?
I believe the Giacalone brothers came to a conclusion that we're just gonna tell everyone a different story, and they kind of got their jollies from it. They enjoyed it. They enjoyed kind of building the mythology themselves. And I know a lot of times there's one kind of famous story, and that whenever they'd be down at the Renaissance Center in Detroit, just so for people to have a little background, the Renaissance Center was being built at the summer of 75 when Hoffa disappeared. And one of the rumors is that they stuck him into the foundation of the Renaissance Center. And I don't believe that's true, but the Giacalone brothers like tweaking people, and they'd be down at the Renaissance Center holding business, and they'd be walking around, and they'd have some friends and they would walk past one of the towers of the Renaissance Center. They'd say, hey, say good morning to Jimmy. And then they were leaving that afternoon. They'd say good night to Jimmy.
Just feeding into that whole legend. Yeah. So, Greg, how much of that was something that the FBI had to contend with, a disinformation campaign?
Well, I mean, it was a problem. And you have to remember, this is 1975. So we don't have a lot of the resources or a lot of the investigative tools that we have today. For example, no cell phones. Jimmy Hoffa, we know, made a phone call back to his wife because he was waiting for Tony Giacalone to show up. And he called his wife from a phone in a hardware store close by to Marcus Red Fox and said, have I received any phone calls? Did Tony Giacalone call? Because I'm supposed to meet him and he isn't here. Hmm. And his wife, of course, answered that she had not heard from him. And that was probably, the last time we know of that he spoke to anybody. At any rate, when it was very difficult for us, because of course the mob, to the extent that they talked, they didn't tell us anything useful. And as Scott says, a lot of it was disinformation. Tony Giacalone made an effort, and it was an obvious effort, to establish a strong alibi as to where he was.
It's a guy that never spoke to anybody that he wasn't directly involved with. And he was at his headquarters, which was about a 10-minute drive from the Marcus Red Fox, the Southfield Athletic Club. And Tony Giacalone was going around to everyone in that club, shaking their hands, asking them how their afternoon was. hey, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And this is a guy that would never, ever have those type of interactions. But that afternoon, he was
everybody
being very friendly and he was glad handing his way through the club.
Right.
And let me also just add to what Greg said. In addition to the misinformation campaign or disinformation campaign, you have a group in the Detroit mob that clams up anyway. They don't talk. Nobody talks. In a American mafia where there have been literally hundreds of informants and rats, Detroit has only had one member of the crime family in 100 years to ever turn government informant.
Hmm.
And that was in 2000. So by the time, you know, in 1975, you had a group of people that you weren't going to be able to shake any trees. In Detroit, that was very difficult for these officers because everybody just, you know, shut down, closed up.
So
zip their lips.
So in that regard, Greg, how does that make the FBI's job look different than it might look trying to weed out something among a crime family in Boston or New York where there's a lot more people and maybe it's a little...
There's more informants in those
right,
families.
More informants.
Well, and that was the problem, at least one of the problems, and that is that we didn't have inside information, source information that we could get. Subsequent to that, we picked up some source information and have over the years been able to piece things together as to, you know, small bits of information here and there. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, what happened to Hoffa, why. And I think we were able to, you know, we were able to put together what happened to Hoffa and why. We know the principles involved, but we don't know specifically how it was done or how the body was disposed of.
Is there a period of time where that answer was as close to being realized as possible and there's just no more traction that's been made?
2013.
With the digging up at the farm, is that what?
Well, there's been a number of farm digs, but the most recent farm dig in 2013 up in Oakland Township, it appeared that was the biggest lead, the biggest tip the FBI had ever gotten, and it came from a very reliable source, and everyone thought that this was a good chance to break the case wide open, and unfortunately, they didn't.
I think most of the agents that, at least the agents that had been involved in the case early on and had worked it over the years, were very skeptical about that. Most of us thought, and we continue to think, that Hoffa's body was destroyed as quickly as possible.
I subscribe to that theory as well.
Not buried. Not buried. No, not buried.
Incinerated.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the places that he could have been incinerated in, which was a sanitation company called Central Sanitation in Hamtramck, was owned by two Detroit mobsters who were also main co-conspirators in the Hoffa disappearance. They owned Central Sanitation, and it just so happens that in 1977, I believe, Central Sanitation burned down in a suspicious arson fire before the FBI could ever get a search warrant to get in there.
The destroying of any potential evidence.
Yeah. And they were very efficient at that. And they knew that without a body, and if nobody talked, it would be extremely difficult to build a case. And of course, that's proven to be true.
But in some ways, it's actually come back to bite them in the sense that we're still talking about it 45 years later. And I've had some very high-level Detroit mob guys that were most likely involved in some aspect of the conspiracy, tell me if we had to do it all over again, we just would have left his body on Telegraph Road.
So that nobody would be paying attention
just
to
it. Just so that
it
would just be over with.
Later.
And
yeah.
For a family that wants to be in the shadows, the fact that every year, every couple years, the story hits in the national news headlines again because of some dig or some search or, you know, it just brings them back into into the spotlight that they don't want to be in.
I think we're probably... and I can't. No one can say for certain, but I think we're probably as close to the answer as we may ever be. And like I say, we know who was involved and why. And it had to do with the Teamsters Pension Fund, and that was a piggy bank for the mob, not only for the Detroit family but for the entire nation.
It built Las Vegas.
It did. They were able to use that money to build casinos in Las Vegas, and then of course the mob would skim money from, and it was lucrative not only for the mob but also for the Teamsters and for Jimmy Hoffa to some extent personally. Jimmy was his own man, and he would help the mob. It was a symbiotic relationship. He would help the mob because he knew the mob would help him.
And symbiotic rather than kowtowing to them.
Exactly. Whereas
there was a quid pro quo.
Right.
Another term that we're hearing in today's zeitgeist.
Well, I want to wrap up by asking a couple larger frame questions. Greg, I'm curious how the entire saga of trying to unpack what happened to Jimmy Hoffa and his body, how that changed things and the way that the FBI maybe operated or investigated large-scale crime in the Detroit area, or maybe nationally.
Well, and it was national, and it did change. There was a sea change as far as the FBI's priorities. It's sort of a myth that we were not involved in investigating organized crime. We actually started in, it was after Appalachia when they had this meeting in upstate New York. But we were involved in wiretapping and doing a lot of investigative work in the early 60s. And now in 1975, when Jimmy Hoffa was abducted and probably murdered by the mob, all that did was shine a spotlight on what we were doing and what the mob was doing, what the Teamsters' connection with the pension fund. And it was sort of ironic, but by doing that, the mob did exactly what they didn't want to have done. And that was that ultimately we focused our investigations on union corruption and the mob and those connections. And we set up surveillance squads, permanent surveillance squads to work that. We under the Omnibus Crime Control Act, we got numerous wiretaps. And ultimately, for example, in Detroit, we made a RICO investigation, a racketeer influence corrupt organization case against the Detroit family. The point is that we prioritized those investigations. We ultimately took over the Teamsters Union Pension Fund and sort of put it in a trusteeship controlled by the government for a long period of time. The irony of it was put in motion by their abduction of Jimmy Hoffa, who they didn't want to have back in control of the Teamsters Union and the pension fund.
Greg, can I add one more thing that I think is important for context here? I believe, and a lot of other researchers believe, that at the end of Jimmy Hoffa's life, he was a full-fledged FBI informant.
Hmm. Greg, can you comment on an FBI informant?
No.
Well, Scott Bernstein is an investigative reporter and an expert on organized crime in America. And Greg Staskel served as FBI agent for 31 years and retired as resident agent in charge of the Ann Arbor office. Scott and Greg, thanks so much for unpacking Hoffa with me. Well, I guess we didn't unpack him, did we?
Let me also just state the Martin Scorsese film is total fiction. See it, and I'm sure it will be a great achievement in cinema, but in terms of historical veracity, it will be lacking very much.
I would agree with that.
Thanks, guys, so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.